Hello, all fellow travelers through the Windor. It's your boys Greg and Toby here, and we're doing something special for you today. Unlike how we meant to go on, where we were specifically reviewing previous books to get new listeners on board and to talk about these stories that many of us have been following and reading and loving for a very long time, Alex has been kind enough to share with us a whole bunch of new material, not books precisely, but preview material on all the stuff that he has planned coming forward. And we wanted to do a little bit of Greg and Toby react to all of this exciting new stuff, because it allow us to go into full fanboy mode and just be like, what does this mean? I need it in my eyes right now.
Full fanboy mode was the alternate title of this podcast. Then Greg held me back.
But all thanks to Toby, this was his idea.
But as a result, this podcast is chock full of spoilers. We will be casually talking about details and important information that has been revealed as late as Uncivil Outlaw. So if you're waiting for the audio drama for that but haven't read the final pages of Uncivil Outlaw, then I would say get out now. We will be talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that one of the very first things to talk about is the cover for Stone Spring Maidens, which is... This was one of the last things that that Alex put out, and it was one of the one I think that caused the most what is going on speculation on the part of not just Toby and myself, but a lot of people. We already knew that, or at the very least, we suspected, based on the ending of Uncivil Outlaw and things that Alex had said since then, was that this was going to be the immediate follow-on from that book. It's entirely possible, especially based on the fact that there is a big gap between the end of Uncivil Outlaw and the coda, where James is reconnecting with Butler and Rebecca for the first time in a very long time. Like, we were expecting these two particular characters to not come back into the story until a lot later. But no, that's the way it turned out. Apparently, Butler had to get back on the horse. I mean, he had time to recover at this point, but things have now gotten serious enough where they had to be sent in to get James back out, and there is now a full-on war going on with the Wendigo.
Yeah, you mentioned that we had not expected to see these characters until a lot later, and the workaround is that little coda is us seeing the lot later. This is 6 months afterwards, and stuff has been changing. James needs a bathtub.
And it's already been revealed to everybody that the man behind White's mask is in fact Thomas Arlington, or maybe the more correct thing to say it's Thomas Arlington, like Darth Vader was Anakin Skywalker. And that
from
seems
a certain
like,
point of view.
Oh dear. Okay, now we're bringing in memes from other franchises at this point. I think both of us are Star Wars fans, but don't worry, we're not going to get into Star Wars here. That's far too much beyond our remit. But as I recall, Uncivil Outlaw specifically ended with a very MCU coda, Harry Arlington and Mr. White will return. And here they are. It looks like they're returning in the very next book. And this story may well involve their confrontation, where she might find out the truth herself. But on top of all of that, first of all, Harry is sporting a way new look. She's gone beyond
and I dig it.
She's gone beyond the goggles and overalls, very sort of really win it Fry from Firefly look that was specific to her in Steamheart. New do, and something that may not be immediately obvious because you've got a zoomed in look for her, is that you can see that there appears to be like, is she sitting in a chair? There seems to be this upholstery that's around back of her. Oh, wait, no, it's in front of her as well. There is additional artwork out there, which only got put out a few days ago at this point. We don't get a close in on it because this is all art. Alex basically commissioned an art book for everything that had been put out for New Century up till that point. That includes everything from Mr. Torreson, the guy that's been doing all of their cover work and a few of the sketches and everything like that. It includes another woman whose name I'm suddenly forgetting right now, but had been doing more childlike sketches.
Like children's art book, sort of thing.
Yes, well, children's art book of certain characters from New Century. Vicky Kuhn is her name, and we'll include a link to her stuff in the show notes as well. And on top of that, a fellow named Diogo Lopez had done some outstanding avatar artwork for Alex and Sharon in the forms of James Penrose and Mortimer Wilson. And most recently, some of the newest artwork has been done by a fascinating new artist named Dios Reveredo, at Dios Boss on Twitter, who has put together one of the things we'll be referring to is specifically a speed draw of one of the new cat heroes from the following book on from Stone String Maidens, this panther, the one that we only know now as Panther Soul. So I've gotten a little bit off topic here, but the point is, in the art book, we see that Harry Arlington has gone full Ironheart. And I say Ironheart because obviously the character that everybody knows is Iron Man, because obviously he was our introduction to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But there is a specific character that was a spiritual successor to Iron Man, a young teenage black prodigy that forged her own armor and basically took up the mantle of Iron Man after he supposedly died at one point and became more like a Jarvis AI. So while Ironheart's armor is far more streamlined, what we've got here with the concept art for Harry's new getup is way more like, say, the Hulkbuster suit from Age of Ultron. And from a certain standpoint, that actually makes sense, because as Tony's designs all look very sleek because he's dealing with future technology, stuff come out of his own head, Harry still is dealing with a far more steampunk aesthetic, which is why you see things like the leather sort of lining that is prevalent on the cover in order to make the rest of her comfortable. Because at the same time, this isn't just a suit. This is a mobile war prosthetic for her. Mm-hmm. We don't know yet if there is a simpler design, or if she gets around in a wheelchair or something like that when she just wants to work in her lab. But it seems very clear that this new suit has a functionality to it that may very well come into play during this potential war between humans and Wendigo.
And it completely makes sense to me that she would take this new creation and make it a part of her, because it's immediately obvious from the first second we meet Steamheart that this is her baby. This is a part of her. And when we sadly lose Steamheart in the town whose name I'm forgetting at this particular moment, but the
Brain Hollow.
Yes, that delightful destination. When we lose the steam heart there, that is like akin to the death of a character. It is a trauma for Harry, and it's like, it's presumptuous to say this is as much of a trauma as her losing the ability to walk, but I think that she really will have taken that trauma to heart, that she lost the pride of her creativity, and now it's like she's taking this armor, and the armor is protecting her, but because she has it close to her at all times, it's almost like she can protect it. Like, she will, you know, what happens to her happens to the armor. So if her creations get destroyed, then by process, so will she. She is taking a much more, like, I forget the Iron Man storyline since we're bringing up Iron Man, but that part where he actually fuses the technology with him to a point where it's sort of coded to his DNA or something like that. And it's very much, I feel like that's the direction that this is maybe not literally going in terms of like plot events, but symbolically, I think that Harry is taking her creations much more like into her own identity and her, the way she presents herself to the world.
Yeah. Taking a closer look at the artwork in the art book, it also seems like there are different versions of the armor. Don't know if this is because of this is meant to be promotional artwork, and so therefore whoever it was that did it for Alex went through a couple different designs. For all we know, we're going to see the creation, much like in the Iron Man movie, of a Mark I and a Mark II. It's even entirely possible that we know that the remains of Steamheart were back. This may be.
Oh, I love that. Please, can that be exactly what it is? Please, can that be exactly what it is?
It's, well, to take into consideration, they don't have a whole lot of resources to hand. They, even if Steamheart was completely unsalvageable as a vehicle, there's no reason they would waste all of the steel and other parts that went into her making, especially if they're going to be creating something as significant as a war suit. The design seems to include multiple mythological themes. It's some ways it almost feels like samurai armor.
I was thinking like that, yeah.
Combination of samurai armor, but with the helmet that she's holding in the full-on pose, where it looks like a knight's helmet, and it's got seemingly a feathered crest on top. So it's a combination of samurai armor and medieval knight's armor there.
I think it certainly, I forget the name of the character who Arlington was training with in, Arlington.
I know exactly who you're talking about, and I forget.
Uncle
Iroh voice, yeah. Just refer to him as that for now. We all know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
There's just way too many details here. We're going to forget a few things along the way.
Yeah.
The character we're referring to here is Master Yagyu, or Toshiro Yagyu.
This is not the usual circumstances where we are looking at a selection of chapters and talking about those chapters. We're kind of talking about the whole series, whole franchise up to this point, and where the whole future of it. So there are a lot of details that we're trying to bring up at a short moment's notice. But anyway, I think that he probably would have had a hand to play. And I mean, when you look at like Mr. White's armor, that's very much like taking the design and sort of structure of a Japanese armor and incorporating it with the technology. And I think the knight's helmet, I'll have to look back at Steamheart. I wonder if Harry has at any point a sort of fascination with knights, if that's like her own personal touch to it, but that might be me trying to like fit this retroactively to it, so don't know. We'll have to see.
I mean, there was already a similarity between Harry's armor and White's armor. So it was definitely made in a similar vein, which makes me think that the man whose name we can't remember very likely assisted in the creation of both. Because that armor is first introduced to us at the beginning of Steamheart. Future editor Greg here. As it turns out, when I went back to Chapter 12 of Arlington to make sure I was pronouncing Master Yagyu's name correctly, I discovered that Steamheart was not the first introduction to White's armor. It's not the focus of the chapter, because first Master Yagyu is telling his story, and then Harry is introducing her armored vest, but Frank does notice it in the background of the workshop and brings it up in conversation with the Swordsmaster. And they were like, no way, I can't have any mobility in this thing. Can you give me something that works a little bit better? And that's how they come up with a better version of the armored jackets that Harry initially made for her mother and father. But so we've got all of that. Here's the real kicker, the one that we have no frame of reference for and really have to go deep into speculative territory. The woman with the green hair.
Character, who dis?
Yeah. The best guess that I can have at this point is that this may be a representative from the other world that up to this point we only know as Autumn. We have no idea what it's like in Autumn. The only time that we've seen any hint of it was when James opened a portal at the climax of Steamheart, at which point we just saw, as I recall, a field. And we know that they've had contact with the denizens of Autumn up till this point, but we don't even know what they look like.
The writing was deliberately sort of keeping that from us. They didn't really sort of describe that. We also know that they know how a watch works. So.
We know how a watch works, but the look that we have going on here is very unlike anything that we've seen in New Century Multiverse up to this point. For one thing, she has pointed ears, and while the natural response to that is, oh, elf, because it's elves that have pointed ears, it is very likely that whatever name these people have for themselves bears no resemblance to that at all, and we're just going to the mythology that we know. On top of that, she has what are apparently glasses, so they have the technology to make things like lenses for corrective vision. She has a coat on that definitely seems on some level like it could be an elvish design, because it's modern, but her lower...
Yeah, the lower half of it.
It almost feels a little bit like leaves. Like it made it look like leaves. Or wings, too. That's another good analogy. So we've got that going on. It's green, and so we often associate green with forest elves and everything like that. But most significantly is the gauntlet. And you have to say gauntlet because there is actually only one of them. Her left arm has an attached sleeve that covers from bicep to wrist, but there is no hand covering on her left hand. Her right hand has the hand covering going all the way down to her knuckles. It has gems all over it. It feels like it has to be significant, like maybe it's magical, or maybe it's technology that just looks magical. It's got a very, to draw upon an intellectual property that I haven't looked at in a very long time, it reminds me of Witchblade, the comic.
And the appearance of it is very, this is an obscure reference, but to any listener who's played the DLC to the latest Fire Emblem game, the Ashen Wolves storyline, one of the characters has this sort of thing he wears on one arm, which isn't quite a gauntlet, that sort of covers like armor all the way up to the fingers. It's like a sort of chain contraction that sort of wraps around the, like, from the elbow up to the sort of like the middle of the back of the hand, but doesn't quite go further than that. So that's the appearance I have, and that comparison doesn't really reveal a lot, but it certainly, I think, makes it feel like it makes the comparison to the Infinity Gauntlet less concrete, because even though there are stones and things like that which make it have a sort of mystical, almost like cosmic appearance to it, it doesn't quite have that solidness to it which makes it seem imposing or threatening. It seems much more like this person has power, but they also have enough of themselves on display and enough of them vulnerable and non like closed off that they seem like they could be a friend.
Yeah.
Or they could not be, who knows.
My supposition at this point, and not everything that I came up with when I first saw, say, all of the logos for all the future books, things that were revealed in between that are clearly not what I thought they were going to be. But when I was diving deep into, okay, what is the significance of the title? Because at one point, the titles were all we had. And I was looking into various incarnations on the web of stone maidens or spring maidens or stone springs, whatever it is. There is some potential mythology that Alex is drawing on, but the best guess that I have at this point is that this may be a term that is native to autumn and or is a term that the green-haired woman introduces to New Century Multiverse and to Harry specifically. Like the Stone Stream Maidens might be some kind of force of heroes or knights, and that it may be an honor that she eventually coins Harry with when she makes her own armor to increase her utility and her combat facades.
I like that. I think the idea of it being a team definitely comes to mind. What I'm thinking of is that the material that Harry uses in the coats that have armor, she refers to as Stone Spring.
Okay.
the tiling there, but it's an odd detail to go from this is a name for a type of armor and now it's becoming the title to a book. But I do know that I think Alex had a couple of titles in mind for this one, but securing a non-copyrighted one was a little tricky. But to be honest, I like this one best.
Well, it definitely evoked the imagination trying to figure out. That's what I'm talking about right there. Then you found the one detail that had completely eluded me because it was in a part of my brain that I completely moved on from back when I was digging deep into the first couple of books or even before that. I don't know. But good pull.
No, but I'm thinking that, it could still be a team of heroes, but what if this is something like a task force which is set up as a sort of collaboration between them, where it and it's very much like a Birds of Prey style, not in terms of the character of the people involved in it, but in a sort of almost like comic book title for it, and all female led team of soldiers and just kick-ass characters who you're very excited to pick up the latest issue of. It sort of has that feeling of dynamicness to it, which I'm excited for.
Obviously, the question suddenly becomes, well, if she's from Autumn or if she's from another world, how in the world did she get here? But that question can be answered very easily because when they first made contact with Autumn, James would open the doors and Abigail would immediately close them. But in his grief, James has been opening every single door he can find almost. So it feels like Autumn might have been one of the first places that he might have tried. And once he's opened that portal, they can't shut it anymore. Abigail's gone. We don't quite know where yet.
All we know is there's Nickelback there, so she's not in a good place.
There are worse things than Nickelback. There are even worse things than 90s America or Canada. So that's what we've got so far, and it's already a fertile field, and the thing that we're going to find out about soonest. I say soonest because Alex hasn't even finished, or hasn't even started, putting out the audio drama for Uncivil Outlaw. On the day this podcast extra comes out, the first chapter of the Uncivil Outlaw audio drama will be premiering tomorrow. Note to self, insert squeal of glee here. I think he started writing Stone Spring Maidens, but he's been focused on finishing up the more arduous work of the audio drama first, because writing, I think, involves less stress overall. He still has to sit down and write it on the computer or whatever. At the end of the day, Stone Spring Maidens is still going to be a long ways off. It's just that Alex isn't resting on his laurels and has a lot of things in motion right now.
He's a madman.
he's a madman, but he's our madman. there wouldn't be a fan podcast if he wasn't so damn prolific.
Wait a minute, Greg. Is that what Through the Wind Door is? Are we like just documenting the descent into madness? Alex is James. He's opening up all these portals, and we're just coming. we're Rebecca and Frank coming up to pick him up and be like, okay, Alex, you doing all right there? I've edited the 18th episode. Yeah, we know you started on Monday.
I mean, I wasn't going to say that, but then again. He has replaced his personal avatar online, where it's no longer a picture of his face. It's a picture of James. So, all right. Let's move on to Panther Soul and this amazing art from Dios Revodero. I think I'm pronouncing that right, because I've only seen it. Seen it read at this point. I never heard anyone actually say it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this picture? I mean, I think he deliberately says this is the new protagonist that will spearhead stories from Rama, specifically because he wants to continue doing things with that world, but the voice actress that had voiced most of Tiger's Eye, Maureen Foley, her voice has gone down significantly, that he never wants to ask as much of her to be the tip of the spear for narrating a book going forward. So he's chosen to make a new character that he himself can voice, because it means that he's being less demanding on other people. He's apparently wanted to voice one of his cat characters for a while, and this is his opportunity to do so.
Well, responding to the picture first and foremost, I'm in love. I've known this Panther Man for coming on 2 weeks, and I would already die for him. So, like, the man crush is very real. And I think it's something about the smile which just makes me think this is a cheeky chappy, and I would like to hang out and see where things go from there. Mm-hmm. Put it this way. I feel like he is the sort of character who would open up, the song from Aladdin he's singing is the first bit of da da na 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 na, like he's the like street rat, ah, da da, like I said this on the New Century Discord, but I want pictures of Panther Man.
Calm down, J. Jonah Jungius. J. Jonah Jungius, that's your new name. No.
J. Jonah Jungius. Thanks for the good news.
Yeah, when I first saw the picture, I don't think I knew that this was going to be the protagonist. And I at first wondered, and I hadn't gone back to check because I've had so much other stuff on my plate. There were two cats, and one of in Tiger's Eye, and one of them was the one with the eye patch, the one that sacrifices himself and that Crow coins when she looks at James, that she sees a familiarity there as a result. One Eye had a companion, and I don't remember if they were panthers. I don't even remember if his companion was male or female. Obviously, we'll get into that when we start talking about Tiger's Eye.
I'm pretty sure they were male. I think, from what I can remember, Tiger's Eye has been so long for me, and I yearn to return to it. I've been like firing off signals left, right, and center on the main series of our podcast, saying I can't wait for us to get to Tiger's Eye. I can't wait for us to get to Tiger's Eye. So that will be a detail we'll double check later.
Yeah, the only reason I think about that is I know Alex is pretty good on the. I'm forgetting what the term is now. It's not the economy of characters, it's the conservation of characters, where he will very often bring people back that have already shown up in a small or large way to fill in gaps along the way. That definitely happened with in Arlington, where it's Annie brings Carl with her on the hunt for the Manticore, and that's actually significant. Because some of us may have developed an attachment for him, the way he came in and was big goddamn hero at the end of Secret Rooms. So having anybody else go, particularly when Carl dies in order to protect his commanding officer, it wouldn't have worked as well. I still miss Carl.
I do.
I'm not ashamed to admit it, because he introduces himself as an asshole, ruthless bandit, but he apparently went through his own arc somewhere along the way and became someone that we don't want to have died.
No, I'm hoping that one of the Phase 2 books is Carl's book, and we just get a sort of Black Widow style story of this character is dead for us at the like furthest point of this series, but that doesn't mean we can't squeeze in one more adventure with them. And who knows, maybe Stone Spring Maidens is a stealth Carl story. I mean, I was certainly... I was certainly hoping for Mr. White to be Carl at the end.
It's me, fuckers! That was a great moment on the interview way back when. The interview really was the place where everything came together. And it made it seem like that this collaboration was going to be possible. So we have the two of them to... thank for bringing us together to begin with.
Yeah.
As far as our protagonist goes here, the reason why I think it is One Eye's companion, and therefore someone we've met before, even in a small way, is that if he's going to be the new voice of Rama, someone that's going to be the tip of the spear in repulsing the lions from Albion, and potentially... eventually coming to Centrum and joining up with our team of heroes there, is that if he's going to make contact again with Harau, if he's going to make contact with Harau and Miguel, then it would help if they had already had bonds forged in fire, like, say, in the battle on board the boat, where Harau accepts Miguel as her son in front of everyone, and he impresses them all for his capability, rather than there having to be like a moment like there was at the very end of Tiger's Eye, where Haka finally realizes that Miguel is a good person, that he's been a judgmental fool this whole time. That would help lube the gears in that way, if they already knew each other. but obviously we can only guess. When I first saw this picture, I don't think he said that it was a protagonist, and given his overall look, I was almost worried with his wild eyes and his toothy grin that he might be an antagonist rather than a protagonist. But based off of the imagery that came to you a little bit ago, I think the thing that I'm now triggering off of is Antonio Banderas in Mask of Zorro.
Oh, I see it. And I think that explains my man crush a lot more as well.
Yeah. That's Antonio Banderas is a very beautiful man. And even though he's a lot craggier now, he still has gravitas and weight to him. Although he doesn't have the same wild mane of hair that he did in, say, that particular role, that would make him just that. I don't have the words for it. I would try to be more coy about that, but my attraction to men as opposed to women is a far more complicated thing, and I sometimes can't always put it into words. But there it is.
No, he's a great protagonist in terms of he is unlike many of the characters I think we've seen in the world of Rama. Way back when Tiger's Eye, I first finished my listen through of it, I was thinking that if Rao was going to spend some time on Sentren, that we would, if we were to get some of the story in Rama, then the protagonist might actually be Haka. And I think that this is, I like your theory of who this character might be, because that would be a great sort of a great pull, a great sort of conservation of things. It would mean that he doesn't have to have like the whole events of the first book explained to him, and he's not a complete sort of newcomer. But I think that just from this one image alone, they already have a strong feel for the character. He looks like he has a sort of devilish, playful side to him, where he will be far less stoic than Hrau is, and he still has that ferocity that will mean that he has a lot. He is of a similar species to Hrau, so it's not like he's a complete opposite. He does operate in the same world and fit there, but he has a very different disposition. And I will say that as much as I love my new boyfriend, Panther Man, I will always stand Hrau. Hrau is, like, there's a reason why when Alex got in touch and asked, who's your favorite character? And I honestly couldn't answer because, I mean, there's so many.
You love
many.
All your children.
I love all my children. Don't make me decide. But Hrau. It's Hrau.
Yeah, I like the idea that our new protagonist is going to have a sense of humor about him that really had only been present in brief stoic moments from Hrau herself or from someone like, say, the Silent One. Because, you know, she's playing a little bit of the Heyoka there, the trickster shaman, when we meet her in Tiger's Eye. But it definitely couldn't, our new protagonist definitely couldn't be Haka, because I think we've established at this point, and we'll talk more about that once we actually get into the details of the book. Haka doesn't do as well on his own. And even prior to, once his teacher left, there was no one around that could tell him no, that could bring him to heal. And I think he knows that now. I think he knows that he needs the Durga tribe to keep him on an even keel, to have someone he is responsible for besides himself, and he needs the superior wisdom of the Silent One to grow off of. So while he will continue to be a leader, he will not be a lone warrior that potentially finds a new family like Hrau did, and potentially like our Panther does.
Well, I'm excited to see where it goes. And, well, as I'm glad that we have gone into detail on these two stories. There are no other things for us to go into detail on.
But well, let wait. Me get... What light through yonder window breaks? Why, it's a whole bunch of new fonts. I mean, technically, that's really all it is a bunch of fonts. But... if you look at the whole, so we're going to have links to all of this on the podcast website. They've been posted around a lot of different places. Some of them may have seen, you've seen them on Patreon. Some of them may have seen it on the Discord server. And he's also posted almost all of it to Twitter as well. There is no one central place that we can point this all to, so I'm just going to put, you know, link to the titles, link to Stone String Maidens, link to the sketch of Panther. If you look at all of these fonts, they're all distinctly different. Even the first eight books, they all have a font and a look to them that are meant to be indicative of this is the kind of story it is. And that continues right up through all of the new fonts there. I am not a font wizard. I keep calling them fonts, and what they are is titles. But I don't have anything else to work on except for the words and how they're displayed. So I feel like I don't think Stone Spring Maidens is meant to be indicative of anything specific. But Panther Soul, I want to say... that font looks very familiar, so there it may be drawing upon something either Afrocentric or something else in pop media that I recognize, and I just can't quite quit to it.
Yeah, but it does. It is of a similar, if not the same, font shape as Tiger's Eye, so that's how you kind of cement the connection between those two titles.
So... now we're continuing on to the stories that we only have the titles to go on. And the one that gets our most attention is the one that is apparently titled The Dragon Thieves, but someone has X'd out that title very sloppily and then written below it, like, maybe they're not really good at using a pen, The Worst Unicorn. Alex has refused to say whether or not there's going to be dueling narratives. When I first saw this, I thought it was actually going to be two books, The Dragon Thieves and The Worst Unicorn, and maybe the stories overlapped and join one group from our Princess Thieves coterie and another group from our Princess Thieves coterie as they go off and do different quests in Kelador. I don't even know now. Are we pronouncing Kelador or Celador? It's changed so many times, even within the story canon, that I can't be sure.
I think that we'll keep our listeners on their toes and we'll alternate it, but in an irregular pattern. Yeah. So it does look like they'll be in Celador, and I'm looking forward to what adventures await them in Kelador.
It also sounds like the Nag very much wants to be the narrator for this story, because I suspect he's the one that X'd out the Dragon Thieves and decided to make it all about him. But he's still self-deprecating, because he admits he is the worst unicorn.
I just want Butler to be able to meet the Nag, like, just once.
I'm sorry, who is it you want to meet the Nag?
Butler.
Butler to me? Oh, right, because he's the one that really likes unicorns.
It's this little trait which I think is such a sort of odd thing, but it's endearing to his character that he's relatively, like, straight-laced and feels like he, when he's sort of like listening to Jeremy talk about fictional stuff, he's someone who will go, oh, okay, you mind any unicorns? Like, that's the one thing that he's like, yeah, I could go for a unicorn.
Yeah. And given his role in Uncivil Outlaw, it feels like there may be some fallout from both the Nag's experiences with James and Abigail, but also that he was basically sent off by Merlaine, and that split up the pair. So he may very well have feelings about all of that, because we still don't know how it was that the Nag and Merlaine were off by themselves when the last time we saw them was as part of the group in Princess Thieves. But Merlaine apparently knew that this meeting was going to happen, or she arranged for this meeting to happen, and she arranged for the Nag to go with them. You know, she's a bit of a mastermind, a bit of a puppet master, trying to set things in motion, much as she did in the Princess Thieves as regards Gwendolyn and bringing her through her arc to finally claim the sword, the Arkenblade.
Yeah.
I called it Excalibur the other day. That was a big faux pas.
That's all right. I'm trying to remember. This might just have been something that Alex sort of let slip at one point, or this might be sort of through some bit of lore that we're trying to remember, that I think the Princess Thieves might actually be occurring sort of somewhat out of sync with the its placement in phase one is not necessarily indicative of at what point in the timeline the events in it are happening.
We have a timeline.
We have a timeline
that shows where Princess Thieves falls into all of that. But that's all we know. We don't know anything about Uncivil Outlaw or any future stories.
Okay.
So it does happen during that same arc. And I think even after I had finished reading finished listening to Steamheart, I was looking at the timeline very closely, because Abigail first meets Merlaine during that drug-fueled dream sequence. And so therefore I was trying to figure out where the overlap was and if I could see if that happened specifically during Princess Thieves and when. But I forget how that conversation went, and honestly, we'll get to that when we finally cover Steamheart far, far, far in the future.
I mean, Greg, I'm looking at this list, which not only shows Phase 2, but it shows Phase 1, and I think the space we've covered is more or less that itty-bitty top left corner. And, we've got a lot of fun ahead of us.
We do have a lot of fun ahead of us. You have a lot of fun ahead of you, listener. so that's that. I don't think we have anything more that we can say about, because all we know about the future story of our heroes from the Princess Thieves is that they have a bunch of potential quests on them, and they have to decide which ones they're going to go on and in what order, much like any good D&D tabletop role-playing game campaign. Now we get to some of the more potentially esoteric stories. Wendigos. I think
never heard of them.
I think this could go in one of two directions. This could potentially be Seth's story, because I don't yet know what the source of the Wendigo army is. It feels like Seth would have to pull them all together in order for them to function like an army to be able to do that. But we do know he has an undeniable connection with the Wendigos, partly because his infected bite will make more of them, just like Wendigos will make more Wendigos. But there is an alternate possibility to this story, and that dovetails to something that happened way back in Secret Rooms, where we saw Wendigo, the corpses of Wendigo laid out around like they starved to death, and there was a Wendigo child, and there were family groups. This may be where we finally explore the emergent behavior that happens when Wendigo aren't eaten in the olive world by the plants.
So what we're looking at here would be like narration. We've seen narration from the perspective of all these different characters. Will this be our first book where we actually see the headspace of someone who has the disease, is a Wendigo, and what that experience is like? Maybe we have different narrator characters, and they're all Wendigos, and mm-hmm. it just gives this, like, I've often described Tiger's Eye when I'm trying to sell people on why it's one of the best books in the series, and just in terms of selling New Century, that Tiger's Eye is very dreamlike in terms of how the narration creates this just fluid like experience. And I feel like Wendigos could be like that, but a nightmare. Like you're seeing the fluid dream state of something which is just experiencing fear. And I don't think Alex will ever write a story which is all sort of darkness, because that's just not the outlook he has, and it's not what he comes to media for. So I don't think he'll do anything like what I'm saying, which is this sort of descent into like vicious madness. But at the very least, it would be interesting to see like that kind of mentality explored. And I think we can probably say for certain that if we can say anything for certain with this, that we are probably going to find out what Seth's deal is.
Yeah, because we're going to find out what Seth's deal is, and Seth himself may not even remember what his deal is, because that was one of the revelations of Steamheart, is that he gave his memories to Yagana for power.
That's true. He likes manticores. We know that much.
Well, you know, Braoff's not a bad sort. Yeah, he ate Rutherford B. Hayes, but, you know, we've never heard Braoff's voice, so who knows? About the only clue I've got to anything is that the Nag would probably think that Braoff is an idiot. an idiot and a thug. But, you know, well, it's...
The Nag thinks everyone's an idiot.
Well, okay. Yeah, that's...
except Malone.
Yeah.
Depends on the day.
I don't think the Nag thinks that Merlane is an idiot, but they definitely have differing opinions a lot of the time. And that brings us to back in time.
Da, 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 da. Can I go back in time?
That's definitely what the title is invoking. When Alex brought this up, like, I think he showed me the logo for Back in Time way back during the Steamheart days. So he was planning this story a long time ago. And he said that this was going to be the closest to a time travel story that he was ever going to do, which implies that it isn't necessarily a time travel story. And that's what makes me think that this is going to be Abigail in the 90s.
That would be cool.
In the 90s, I was wearing a Stetson hat. I didn't know who Nickelback was.
Why do they dress like that?
Oh, we are ridiculous nerds.
You're getting that now?
But we're letting it free reign here, because we don't have serious topics to discuss. We are just here geeking out over this this piece of media that we love. So yeah. We're just letting it all out, and it's fine, because, you know, I would hope this is the content that people are here for as much as serious discussions of media and literature and all the like.
And to kind of pick up on what you bring up with Alex saying that this would be the closest he does to a time travel story, I think that with Uncivil Outlaw, it kind of lays out that, and this is probably his way of, like, Alex is all too aware of the sort of, like, brain-melting loops in logic that you have to kind of embrace whenever you do a time travel story. See the Back to the Future episodes and the headaches that invokes. But I think that in Uncivil Outlaw, they clearly sort of lay out with Krieger and Greta's deal that they aren't really traveling back in time. They're traveling to like an alternate world, which, you know, is to the side of it, but it's like they're not in the same point in time. So it's this weird thing where you're, it's more like you're dimension hopping. And yeah, I wonder what like Abigail will bring back with her, like if there'll be any, what in the 90s would Abigail really be into? Like, say in the comments what you think that Abigail will be sad to leave behind, or if she's like, no, I can't get out of there fast enough.
I can barely guess at this point. The only guess that I had way back when, that's because this was one of my comments while reading through Uncivil Outlaw the first time. The one of the anchors that she's going to cling to as she gets accustomed to our future is A1 sauce. That's the only... The recipe has probably changed a little bit between 1883 and 1990, but it's called A1 sauce. It probably tastes... A1 sauce has a strong flavor, so it probably tastes something like what she's used to. So, yeah, if when we talk about Guillermo del Toro totems, that's going to be her future totem, is a bottle of A1 sauce.
I dig it.
But I do agree. Yeah, this is one of the things that Alex has been very slow to reveal, is that the New Century Multiverse is 10 worlds. And we already know the names of several of them, and they are all are very unlike our own reality, because, you know, Centrum, of course, has the difference in that the Wendigo have been introduced. We know that the world that the Wendigo came from. We know Rama. We know Kelador. We don't know most of the other worlds at this point. Okay, we know Autumn. We know that one. That still leaves a lot of room to try and figure things out. And one of the things discussed in Uncivil Outlaw is the idea that James could open up a portal to a version of their world that is not their world. Like, literally parallel dimensions that are slightly off-center, so they're not actually going home, and therefore they need to be very careful about that. So this is, as you say, likely to be an analog of our modern future, probably as close to our world as it can get, but it's not actually going to be our world, and that's because when you look at the logo showing the worlds of the New Century Multiverse, and you count each name and each world has a color associated with it, there are only 9 worlds there. The 10th world is you and me. The 10th world is us looking into the New Century Multiverse and reading their stories and being fans of it.
Well, that's why we're looking at things through the wind door.
All right, well, we only have one thing left to cover, and that is Hidden Doors. We know one thing about Hidden Doors that Alex has said, and that is that this is going to be the equivalent of Infinity War in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is significant in its own way, because Endgame followed directly on from Infinity War in that line. But the way he's laying it out here, where it's the penultimate narrative arc, like Steamheart was the narrative arc for Phase 1, that means that it is entirely possible that Hidden Doors are where it's going to get its darkest, because that's what Infinity War was in the MCU. It involved a team-up of almost all of our heroes up till that point facing an enemy, but they eventually lost. And we don't actually know yet who they're going to lose to. It could be Seth, or it could be somebody that we meet during all of these other books that Alex has planned. The one piece of speculation that I have, and obviously I haven't had this confirmed to me, this is just me and my wild considerations, is that I felt like there was some sort of synchronicity between the title Secret Rooms and the title Hidden Doors.
I believe so.
I suspect that we already know that Alex loves his nonlinear storytelling, and that the story of Greta and Krieger is not done yet, even though we now know that they set into motion a chain of events which has only led to greater chaos. Well, it has led to the world being the way it is, but, you know, it has still resulted in a lot of life lost along the way. But I think that we very well may see the backstory for Krieger, Greta, and Charlotte as being one of the flashback cornerstones of Hidden Doors.
I think you're right in that in many ways the sort of biggest entity, like, it's that sort of weird thing that it's maybe not the most sort of healthy thing to look at a developing narrative series and go, oh, who's the biggest bad that they can take on? Because, like, usually it's the situations and scenarios that are the things that are creating conflict. And with Uncivil Outlaw, which obviously has a lot of connections with Civil War, it was very much a case of these protagonists of these stories we've seen up to this point butting heads because they have these different perspectives on how to achieve things or how to best achieve them. And even so, even looking at it, Greta, Krieger, and Charlotte are the people who have opened the doors to all these different places and are responsible for everything. They are responsible for, you know, Miguel and Trow meeting. They are responsible for, they have not just impacted the fate of their world, but because Harao went on this quest with Miguel, it set off the events of Tiger's Eye, and now the world of Rama is in this place where the people of the Western continents are preparing for the Lion Empire and the war that will be starting soon there. That has taken a fundamental shift. So they really have rippled out and made everything go differently. So if they are going to be looking at the most sort of, if Infinity War and Hidden Doors are the places in their respective series where the focus and the scale of everything widens out to where we start to consider everything, then that could very much be who it all revolves around. And in fact, the comparison now to me isn't necessarily Infinity War, it's Doctor Strange, the point at which you sort of start, like, thinking things on such a vast scale that it becomes this sort of infinite refracting of things that you can get lost in. And I love the way that a lot of these titles are very sort of mirroring titles from the first one, but they're not just hidden rooms, they're like hidden doors. There's this thing there, and Tiger's Eye, like Panther Soul, there is this mirroring of, like, and I can't quite explain it except on an emotional level. It feels like, you know, they're not just saying The Princess Thieves 2, it's a sort of worthy successor where it doesn't feel like we're stepping on anything that came before, but we're actually taking these various threads and weaving them into something new.
I have two more thoughts which came up while listening to you, and I'm going to pull my one tiny piece of font magic because I suddenly realized that I recognized what I was looking at. In the Infinity War theme, I think this may be a war on multiple fronts, a culmination of the war in Centrum, of the RSA versus the Wendigo, and Tremaine's forces as well. We have to remember that Uncivil Outlaw began with a completely different war. It could also include whatever plans Coriolanus had for Europe, and it may also be the war for Harao and our Panther Man's continent. I don't think that it's like the equivalent of the New World, but I don't remember if Durga tribe and all of the other tribes actually call it something. It's just that the Lion Empire is called Albion. So we may see multiple wars taking place on multiple fronts, And here's why I suspect that. The font for Hidden Doors is the exact same fucking one as the one for the Black Panther. But they used the font for the Black Panther movie, but that font was also the one used for the Black Panther comic. And it's that fucking dagger N that clued me into it. If you go to the Black Panther movie, just like the Wikipedia, you'll see it's that same exact fucking N.
Okay. This has implications that I'm not sure I realize where all of them are going, but
yeah.
That's for future discussion episodes, I suppose.
I mean, okay, it may not be exactly the same font, but I suspect that, yeah, okay, if you look at the H in Panther and the H in Hidden, that H is squished a little bit, but it's close enough that it's hard for me to not draw parallels there, because Alex loves layering his fields of meaning. So, yeah.
And this is less to do with, like, the sort of shape of the font and more to do with the color coding, that the yellow, and maybe it's just because it's against a black background in this image we're looking at, but that sure looks like a Star Wars sort of title in a way, and it just makes me feel like, this could be a sort of grand, like, epic of some sort, but who knows? Sorry, yeah, we always have a different phrase that we say far too often in each episode. Mine for this one is, who knows? And obviously the answer is Alex. Alex knows.
In theory.
In theory.
If there's one thing I appreciate about Alex's process, is that he's always been upfront about the fact that he doesn't always necessarily know where things are going to go. You'll remember during the interview that we did with him, that he didn't have completed arcs in mind for all of his major characters, because in order to be able to put them in danger, he had to actually feel like they were in danger. Therefore, he wasn't writing anything into stone. So, yeah, that's things may change along the way. And I know that he apparently had a major breakthrough back when he was struggling with finishing Uncivil Outlaw specifically, and he finally knew what Stone String Maidens was going to be about, and he basically unclogged his writer's block there. So I'm excited. I know that we have a long way to wait, but fortunately we have so many other things to occupy ourselves with and to occupy the New Century Multiverse fan base with our podcast. So, yay.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of what motivated this particular episode, is that in many ways, this is a really exciting time to be a fan of this series, because, you know, we've got a bunch of news about things on the horizon, which anyone who's been part of the ride along this knows that Alex is a human being. He needs rest, and he needs to, at certain points along the way, reevaluate things. And, you know, Steamheart took time, and as a result, we got Let Them Go, which you've listened to at least the first episode of our shows on it. You know, we love it. But it's also just, we've got a new audio drama adaptation of a book that, because we've read, we know is, you know, got some compelling stuff, and we're looking forward to certain performances. Like, Chapter 16, I think, was just edited today, and I can only imagine how intense the performances that Alex and Sharon were giving, that Alex had to, like, comb through and listen through, so that would have been an experience. But, and this feels like I'm really sort of putting a lot of stock in our show, but I believe in it, that's why I do it, is that now that we're looking into it, we're sort of, by going back to these old ones, it's injecting new life into the stories that we already have, because we want to get more people involved, and we're already starting it. Let Them Go. At the moment, I have been thinking a lot about three New Century stories. I've been We've had episodes on Let Them Go, which are coming out. We are looking at and recording episodes at the moment on Secret Rooms. Uncivil Outlaw, I just finished rereading because there's a new audio drama adaptation on the horizon. There's so much exciting stuff, and I can barely contain myself. And I know that this sounds so much like unbridled enthusiasm, and it is. It completely is.
And in the meantime, there's a growling horde outside your door that wants to know, when the fuck are we going to cover Tiger's Eye?
Soon! kind of. We're covering Secret Rooms right now. We're about halfway through. Then we're going to do a couple of episodes on Cartographer's Handbook. We know, that'll be done. And then it's Tiger's Eye. But you've got to wait. And, in the meantime, look out for the Wendigos, because they are also out there. They've probably gotten Trump by now, but, we'll keep it. Wait a minute, that's a running gag for a later point. You guys won't get that yet. Cut it out.
I hate waiting. I could give you my word as a Spaniard. All right, well, we're gonna close it up here. We've got other things to take care of, including recording the next episode of Secret Rooms. It's going to be a little bit longer of a wait because I need to get ahead of myself with the episodes that I have promised for Let Them Go. But we are also going to have our first fan interview where they are going to get to talk about their experience with Let Them Go and their expertise with horror stories. Very much looking forward to talking with Nick Ord, a longtime fan of School of Movies, and only recently of New Century. He is an even later comer to the game than we are. But in the meantime, I have a special message for Alex Shaw. Hey, dude, sit down. Have a cup of tea. Have a sandwich. Please give your hand a break. You've given us all this great stuff. We don't want you to keel over before you do it all.
Hair. Fucking hair.
And for all of our listeners, we'll see you on the next trip through the wind door.
Take care.